Everyone has a story. How they got here, where they met along the way, the choices they made, the dreams they are chasing. Welcome to Anthologies of Hope. Welcome back to Anthologies of Hope this week, and thank you all so very much for joining us each and every week. As always, I'm your host, Rick Osowski, and I'm not a mental health professional in any way, simply a mental health advocate with a passion for storytelling. We've had a lot going on the past few weeks, and I cannot wait to bring all of it to you over the course of this month. If you're not aware, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and all of our favorite mental health organizations are sharing a plethora of information and resources across all of their social media channels, Try Love in Our Arms and Hope for the Day included. This obviously isn't the only time to share these resources, but it's a great time to adopt some of them into your tool belt for when they can come in handy, either for yourself or a loved one. On May 1st, we recently celebrated the one-year anniversary of the Sip of Hope Coffee Bar right here in Chicago's Logan Square neighborhood. If you haven't listened to many of our episodes yet, Sip of Hope is the world's first coffee shop where 100% of the proceeds go towards proactive suicide prevention and mental health education. It is run by Hope for the Day, one of our favorite nonprofit organizations here at Anthologies of Hope, and just so happens to be the location of all of our live Conversations Cafe episodes as well so far. During the anniversary celebration at Sip of Hope, we recorded over 2 hours of interviews with Sip of Hope staff, Hope for the Day staff, friends and partners of Hope for the Day, as well as local community members supporting what the coffee shop stands for in both their professional and everyday life. Mike Van Opel of Hope for the Day will be joining us to help with a fun supercut episode of all of these interviews later this month. These interviews will include Johnny Boucher, founder and CEO of Hope for the Day, members of the Dark Matter Coffee family, and Cook County Commissioner Louis Arroyo. In the meantime, we have two more awesome conversations with members of the Hartkamp family, this week included, as well as an additional upcoming Conversations Cafe event that will be taking place at Sip of Hope next Wednesday, May 15th. If you are going to be in Chicago that day, head on over to Hope for the Day or Sip of Hope's Facebook events page to check out for more details. These upcoming episodes will be putting a wrap on our second season and ending it on a high note for sure. We will definitely be back for an upcoming season 3 in the fall, or spring for our listeners in the Southern Hemisphere, but we will be taking the summer off now that the arrival of Baby O is very, very imminent, as we discussed in Amanda's episode a few weeks back. So now, picking up where we left off with our traditional episode formats, we are continuing our interviews with members of the Hartkamp family. If you're not familiar with Hartkamp, we dive deep into the ins and outs of it in our first two episodes from season 1. But as a quick refresher, Hartkamp is a brainchild of Jamie Torkowski and a 2-day workshop focusing on authenticity, writing, bringing your heart to work, and mental health. For more info on Hartkamp, you can check out hartkampwithjamie.com for details or use the hashtag Hartkamp18 on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. This week's guest, Sarah Colbert, was the second person of the Hartkamp family that I ever met, with season 1's guest, Kenneth, being the first. Sarah covers her trip to Hartkamp in detail, but more importantly, the journey up to that point that led her to make the decision to attend. I'm so grateful for Sarah joining us this week, as she brings a topic we haven't really covered much on Anthologies of Hope so far. The aspect of mental health and the professional workplace is a very important one. We have a pretty frank conversation about what it's like to work in an environment that is detrimental to your mental health, how big of a difference it makes to work in an environment that benefits your mental health, and using all the tools at your disposal to make that change for the better. As I previewed last week, my conversation with Sarah is one that hopefully brings light to the understanding of the fact that returning to where you started is not the same as never leaving. This is a quote from the author Terry Pratchett, but also similarly falls in line with the sentiment that you can never go home again. Sarah's story is one that proves that you can in fact go home again and become stronger and more resilient because of it. As you know, we are curating a pretty epic playlist of our season 2 songs as we move forward, filled with both contributions from myself and our guests. You can find it at anthologiesofhope.com/playlist. You'll still be able to find the season 1 playlist under our user account on Spotify or anthologiesofhope.com/playlist-season-1. Sarah's contribution to the playlist this week are excellent, as she is one of the reasons Jack Mannequin made their way into my selection a few weeks back. So be sure to check out her songs at the end of the episode this week. My contribution to the playlist this week would be an entire album if I wanted to break all the rules, but I'll still limit it to just 2. During the course of our interviews last week at Sip of Hope, Johnny Boucher recounted some stories with Rise Against in the early days of Sip of Hope while it was still just percolating as an idea. As such, I hadn't listened to much Rise Against lately in the chaos of our move and preparation for Baby O being inbound. This led to my discovery of the not-so-recent Ghost Note Symphonies album by Rise Against. And guys, this album is absolutely bonkers. I loved each and every one of these songs and their original albums, but now you're able to connect to each and every word in the lyrics when you would otherwise be paying attention to the driving guitars and drums. The two songs I want to call out this week for my contributions have some very special lyrics that I've heard 1,000 times over, but never really took them to heart until I heard them in this format. The first entry is from the song Miracle. This one simply needs no explanation or contextual connection, as the lyrics pretty much speak for themselves. They are, "When the weights we carry break us, we're tempted to stay down, but every road to recovery starts at the breakdown." If that is not the foundation of why Anthologies of Hope exists, I don't know what is. The second entry for my selection this week is Savior. I've loved this song from the first day I heard it, but it was always a pump-up song for me based on the tempo and the vocals. Hearing it in the format of the Ghost Note Symphonies brings so much more meaning and clarity to the already amazing song. Make sure to pay attention to the chorus and the two different characters in the song attempting to understand the ideals of trying to save someone and trying to be saved. This sentiment is one that resonates not only with our Conversations Cafe content from last week, but also a number of our guest interviews over the past two seasons. Each week, we'd like to remind you that if you're in a time of crisis, we'll be covering a range of potentially difficult topics. Please use this as a warning to seek help and come back to listen once you are in a more positive season. If you are in need of help, an abundance of international resources can be found on the Find Help pages from Detroit Love in Our Arms and Hope for the Day. Detroit Love in Our Arms can be found at TWLOHA.com/find-help. And Hope for the Day can be found at HFTD.org/find-help. As always, you can find us at AnthologiesOfHope.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Anthologies of Hope, on Twitter as Anthologies Pod, or email us directly at AnthologiesOfHope, all one word, no punctuation, @gmail.com. Please like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, or wherever you're finding us. Without further ado, here's this week's episode, Anthologies of Hope, Sarah Colbert.
Okay, I'm Sarah Colbert. I am currently teaching eighth grade in a small town in Missouri. This is my second time around teaching. I took a break for a while, went to grad school, ended up in Waco, Texas, and now I'm back in Missouri after a long trip to Heart Camp and some other stuff, and so here we are.
Excellent. The twice go around for teaching and the in-between part is the central part to a lot of your story and kind of where you're at now and what brought you to Heart Camp. So
absolutely.
Jump into that. I know you're familiar kind of in some of the prep. You said you were familiar with the Enneagram, so we'll jump into that too. It's interesting so far where the majority of everybody I've talked to lately, if not kind of we've released episodes for so far, has been also on the like INFJ side of things with a heavy focus on the I part.
Yeah.
Knowing that we'll kind of bury the lead on that one and know where we'll get to eventually on some of the Enneagram stuff. But if folks can kind of play the sleuth and figure that out as we're going through this, since you said you're a fan of murder podcasts, play some Scooby-Doo and the gang here to figure that out.
Sounds like a plan.
Kind of jumping right in, where or what's some of your journey with where you're at? Mental health, what you've been through, any events, any, you know, catalysts that you would say are a part of your journey to figure out where you were heading and either first time go around with school, first time teaching?
Okay, so I always like to tell people that I never wanted to be a teacher. I always said that I just did not have the patience for it. I did not like kids and I was going to be a lawyer. And I was going to study history and then go to law school. And that just, the longer I was in school and the closer I got to college, that just seemed less and less ideal, but I still wanted to study history. And so I just kind of went with it. And I was like, well, what do you do with a degree in history other than like teach, I guess? So I'll go to school and I'll become a teacher. But where I live, if you're not a dude who coaches football, it's really hard to find a history teaching job. So in the state of Missouri, once you hold certification in one area, you can test into another area. And so I was like, well, I'll just do my English stuff. It'll be fine. And I graduated from college in 2008 in December, which is, you know, a really weird time to find teaching jobs. And so I lived with my parents for a while, which is kind of a recurring theme in my story and in my journey. And then, you know, summer rolled around and I still didn't find a teaching job and I didn't find a teaching job. And then it was like September and the school in this town I had never heard of was looking for an English teacher for their high school. I was like, well, it's September. I'd really like a job. So let's go for it. And they ended up hiring me. And it was kind of a weird situation. The guy who had been teaching there for a few years had just kind of went off the deep end, called in sick for a week, and then was just like, by the way, I'm not coming back.
I've actually heard both with previous sets of friends and a kind of extended network, that actually happens more often than you'd expect, where teachers are just like, peace out, and I'm not coming back.
You know, teacher burnout is like a super, super real thing. But yeah, this guy like called in sick for a week and was just like, by the way, I'm not coming back. And also, I still have all of the keys. See you later. So I didn't have a key to my classroom for like a week, which is like a weird feeling because they would have to leave my door unlocked and I'd get to school in the morning and there'd be students in my classroom, like sitting in the dark, which was always really weird to me. But for a while, things were really good. And every so often, there'd be like an opening for a social studies teacher, and I'd really want to move into that. But that's what sucks about being really good at your job. When you're good at your job, they don't want you to change what you're doing.
Exactly.
And so I was stuck teaching the subject that I wasn't really crazy about. And then in my last year of teaching, the first go round, we had some major changes in administration. We got our superintendent had to resign in the middle of like the previous year, and they replaced him with a guy who had been a teacher at our school and had left to go be a superintendent somewhere else. And then he came back the next year, and then the principal that had hired me, and I loved her, she ended up being let go and was replaced by someone who was not your ideal candidate. Mm-hmm. He had gotten in trouble at his previous school for some things and was, you know, asked to leave. And so then we hired him. And it was just this like really awful, really hard situation. I did not enjoy working with him. I did not enjoy working under him. I was really unhappy. And it kind of got to this point where I was having trouble getting out of bed and going to work and was just miserable. And I look back now and I didn't go to a doctor or anything like that, but I have every reason to believe there was like some situational depression going on. And so I just had this really bad day at school one day, and I called my mom on the way home crying. I was miserable. I was so unhappy. I felt like I was really bad at my job and I just wanted out. Mm-hmm. And so I called my mom crying, and she's like, your dad and I've been talking. And I have really, really, really incredible parents, which is kind of another thing that'll come up as my story comes along. I have parents that are like insanely supportive, and I love them so much for that. But she's like, your dad and I've been talking, and you've talked about going to grad school for a while. So why don't you just quit teaching, move home, and we'll help you go to school. And so here I am in my like late 20s, quitting my job, moving back in with my parents again, and like totally not sure what's going to happen with my life, which is kind of a weird place to be. And so I ended up working at Starbucks for a while in St. Louis. I lived at home in my parents' basement, which is like every late 20-something's dream. And went to grad school and got a degree in library and information science, which, yes, to be a real librarian, you do have to have a master's degree in library and information science or something related to that. And I was really happy there for a while. Like, things were really, really good. Even though I was living in my parents' basement, I had made some really good friends in St. Louis. And I just knew that when time came to graduate, I wanted to move away. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to try something so different. And I just, at this point, I knew, or I thought I knew, I didn't want to be in teaching anymore. I, you know, and I wanted to be a public librarian. and I wanted to be a teen services librarian. So as a high school teacher, I love teenagers. I think they're so weird. They're so wonderful. And there's just something really fun about them, which is the thing that a lot of people look at me really crazy for. But I also think people who are like, I love elementary school and I can't teach anything but kindergarten are kind of, I don't even know what's wrong with them. Because that sounds like the worst idea and the worst time ever. Sorry, kindergarten teachers. It's true. And so I got this job in Waco, Texas. And I was so, so, so excited. And I've always been really independent. I've always been pretty introverted, which is where that big old I comes in.
Yep.
So I was like, it's fine. I'm moving away 13 hours away from my family. I'm moving somewhere that I've never been, that I don't know anybody. But holy cow, it's Waco, Texas. It's home of Fixer Upper. It's got to be the best thing ever. Because you should totally base major life decisions on things you see on TV shows, kids. And so I did. We packed up all of my stuff, and my mom and I drove down to Waco, Texas together, because at the age of 30-something, I also was not, like, old enough to drive myself.
How far of a drive is that?
It's like 13 hours.
Okay, so yeah, it's
like miles or something crazy like that.
Having lived on the East Coast, spent a good amount of time vacationing on the West Coast, and now living in Chicago, I still know where everything is there. But again, still, when you were talking about that,
right,
and planning the trip and figuring it out, and some of what we'll get to later, like, I didn't realize it was that long of a leg. I was like, oh that's yeah, a couple of hours. It's like 6-8 hours at most. But then having it be that long ends up being a little bit more of a pain in the ass to do it in a single shot.
Right. And so I got to Waco and I started my job, and I was really lonely. I didn't realize I would be so lonely. And so the first thing I did when I had like a free weekend, it was Labor Day weekend, I went and I adopted a dog. And
how long had you been there by that point?
Like about a month.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd been there like a month, and I was like, I'm lonely. I want a friend. I need to adopt a dog. And so I went to this rescue in Waco, and I found this dog, and he had been there for a really long time. He had this really sad story, and I'm a sucker for a sad story. And so I was like, he needs to come home with me, as I'm like crying in the room. The dog is like barely looking at me. And so it was Labor Day weekend. The library was closed for a couple of days. And so we had a really good couple of days at home. And then I had to go to work the next week, and I couldn't get him crated and was like 45 minutes late to work one day trying to like wrestle him into a crate. I come home and he has like started to eat the trim around my door frame, and I panic and I start crying, and I'm like, I have to send this dog back. And it was just this really stressful time. And so finally, like, I talked myself down off of my ledge, and I was like, okay, it's okay. We're going to figure it out. And I still to this day tell people that Henry, my dang dog, is about the best thing that happened to me in Waco, Texas. He stayed. He still ate the trim around my door. He pulled the vertical blinds all down off of my windows one day while I was away at work. But we made it work. And now he is laying at the foot of my bed, because it's about the only room in the house that he doesn't go crazy in when we're in there together and stuff happens outside. And so that was really good. That was a good thing that came out of that. But as I was there and kind of as like work went on, it just was not this really like great, happy, positive experience I had hoped it would be. And I kept having these interactions with the library director, who was like my boss, that were just super negative. And it's really disheartening when someone tells you like that they're disappointed in you, and they're like, aren't sure that they made a good choice in hiring you, and that you're not very good at your job and all of this stuff. And you've only been there like 3 months, and they're like, I don't really know. You interviewed so much differently, and we were really excited about you coming and being here, and now I'm just not sure.
Yeah. Those aren't conversations to have in common casual workplace water cooler conversation. So
right,
unless those are specific performance review type conversations, right, where they're structured and more actionable, then those are things where that's just a bad workplace, bad leadership mentality that is unfortunate that you have to deal with that.
And it kind of just became this thing. And again, I think there's some like situational depression happening. I think there's a lot of stuff going on. I was really homesick. I was lonely. I have this person who's telling me that I'm a mistake in being hired and like all of these things.
Yeah, screw like the little devil sitting on your shoulder. You've got one that's, you know, walking around and looking over your shoulder at work telling you that exact thing.
Right. And so it's to the point where like I would physically nauseous anytime I would open my email because I was afraid I'd have an email from the library director wanting to meet with me again. Or if I would drive up to work and I would see their car in the driveway or in the parking lot, it was just this like physical, like visceral reaction of like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And so we had a meeting together and she had come up with this like unofficial, official workplace performance enhancement plan. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to do everything I was doing, but I was also the only person in my position in this library system. So I was doing the work. I was doing all of my work at four different branches. And so I was having to plan activities and programs for four branches. I was having to do the collection development and acquisitions for four branches. I was also having to do circulation desk stuff and reference desk stuff. And so I'm the only person doing all of this in my position. Mm-hmm. And it was really, really difficult because I just felt like I'm only one person. I can only do what I can do. And I was also, whatever my job was classified as, I was not allowed to have overtime.
Okay.
And so I had to do it all in like a 40-hour work week.
Yep.
Which is really, really difficult. And so,
especially across multiple physical locations, and there's context switching and travel and all of that stuff where it just doesn't make sense.
Absolutely. And so it was just really, really hard. And my parents and I would Skype every Sunday or FaceTime every Sunday for about an hour, kind of catch up on how things were going. And it was, I think, February. And I'm just talking to my parents. And again, I just like burst into tears, crying. I'm like, I'm so miserable. I want to come home. I want to come home. I want to come home. And my parents are like, okay, we'll figure something out. We'll get you home. Like, again, I just cannot emphasize enough, like, how fantastic my parents are, which I know is like a super uncommon thing, mm-hmm. it feels like these days. So I'm so, so grateful that I do have parents that are super supportive of me. And even to this day, my dad will still tell me, like, when he sees me, he's like, you know, I'm really glad you're not in Texas anymore. And I'm like, yeah, me too. And so there came a day where I decided, like, I'm okay. I'm like, okay, this is it. Like, I'm going to turn in my resignation. And it kind of coincidentally coincided with going to Heavy and Light after Heart Camp. Because while all of this is going on, I had made the decision back, I think, in like November. I was like, I don't know. I'm in this weird period of transition. Jamie says that Heart Camp is for people who are in transition. I don't know. I'm just going to do it. Let's see what happens. And so I had gone to Heart Camp in January and just had this really incredible experience. And so I knew that if I timed my resignation just right, I would be able to make it to Heavy and Light and not have to worry about like rearranging my work schedule, mm-hmm. and having to travel around my work schedule. And so I had a day that I was supposed to meet with the library director again and then my branch manager. And so I went into work that morning and I didn't have any ink for my printer at home. So I went into work a little early and I printed my letter of resignation off at work. I paid for it on the copy machine. So I didn't use like the library's ink and paper to do it. But I printed my letter of resignation off at work. And I told my branch manager, I was like, can we talk before the director comes in? And she's like, yeah, sure. And so we go into her office and I like slide the letters across the desk to her. And I was like, this is my letter of resignation I'd like to turn into you.
This is very warm. Did you just print this here?
No. It's just very warm. And so she just looked at me and she's like, I did not see this coming at all. She's like, I want you to know I'm going to cry about this later. She's like, but okay. And so she talked to the branch or to the director first. And then I went and talked to the both of them. And then I went to Heavy and Light and I came back to Texas and spent some time like packing up. Tying up loose ends, all of that good stuff. And then my mom flew down and we drove back to Missouri and I moved into my parents' basement again.
Take two.
Yeah. Or three. Or something. It's, I don't even know. I've kind of lost count. So that kind of experience in my life helped me to realize that I really missed being in a school environment. And so I just started looking for like school library jobs again or teaching jobs again. And I got really, really, really lucky with this job I've gotten right now. I'm living in a town where I have friends who have already been living here for about a year. And so they were able to like plug me in with some people that they know at the school and like in a church setting and stuff like that. I also have really supportive bosses who tell me on the regular basis, like how much they like me,
which is a novel concept,
right? Like, which is super great. And they tell me like what a good job I'm doing, you know, all of this stuff. And so right now I'm just really happy. Like things have been good, and except for the fact that eighth graders have really terrible body odor and haven't figured out how to like shower and wear deodorant yet, like teaching is going good.
Especially in the winter when the heat is awkwardly turned up super high and everybody's inside, yeah. The windows are closed, wearing sweat clothes and they're all sweating. Yeah, so yeah. That ends up going a long way.
And it's like, you know, the same hoodie they've worn for a week. And they haven't figured out that wearing socks with your shoes is still a super good idea yet. Because they're eighth graders and they're weird. And so that's just kind of my journey to where I am right now.
So, I mean, it seems like you're unfortunately on the wrong end of the shitty corporate structure of some of the education/library area of it when you were spending time in Texas with just bad leadership, and that ends up trickling all the way down in the worst way possible. Because again, when you're kind of interacting with, you know, multiple levels of superiors in the management chain, where I've had many close friends and other people that I've known that are in the education field growing up, it was always like, oh, it's like magical rainbows and ooh, it's cool. The principal sitting in on the teacher to watch us and stuff like that. They're like, they're watching us, so be good. And it's like, well, no, they're there because they have to do reviews for teacher X and everything. So seeing the, now having been in the corporate world for, you know, 15 years, seeing the flip side of that and how they have to manage schools like that kind of puts a little bit of a different view on it. But the unfortunate aspect of you being in a new place, traveling so far, getting hired out, and then having somebody that doesn't really know how they should interact with people in a professional setting, like as far as leading them and trying to help them grow professionally, as opposed to just crapping on somebody all day long. Like that doesn't help anybody. So, I mean, again, that ends up saying more about the other person than you, but I'm glad you were able to find a way out, even though it was like a penultimate moment that, you know, you burst out into crying on a FaceTime session and figured it out, but you got there.
I did. And they, you know, were talking about like the observation they've done of me. It's like having to remember, like, they are supportive of me and this is not going to be a negative interaction. And also, you are not like human garbage who can't do anything, which is kind of how I felt in the other situation when I was in Texas.
But that's a good point for transition to talk about transition anyway.
Yeah.
So you had mentioned where HeartCam kind of fit in towards the tail end of your journey, where you ended up now. So how did you end up hearing about HeartCam? I mean, this is something you and I haven't really talked about, even though we've been in communication a lot more since obviously the first HeartCam. But when did you get introduced to Detroit Love? How long did you follow it? How did you hear about it? And kind of just either through Jamie or through books and just kind of, how'd you hear about it to get there to Florida in the first place in that period of transition and uncertainty?
You know, I've tried to think about when I first heard about, like, To Write Love on Our Arms and Jamie, and it has to be one. It has to be, like, back in the MySpace day, because I'm an old lady, and so it has to have come out of MySpace. And
everybody keeps saying that, and I'm like, I don't think I ever actually had a MySpace page. And so everybody else keeps saying that MySpace, or they'll be like, well, it was around when they started, but I didn't have MySpace. I'm like, I still don't know if I ever had MySpace, and I'm the computer nerd who usually signs up for everything. So right. Yeah, that's here nor there.
No, I definitely had a MySpace, and I think it had to have been kind of around that time when it kind of first started. I think I remember reading the story, or maybe even just like seeing the t-shirt and being like, that's a cool shirt. Like, what's that about? And looking it up on the Google machine. Actually, I don't think there was a Google machine back then. You know, I think that's kind of where I first like heard about it and kind of started kind of digging into it and following it. And I just really loved this idea of being the hope for the hopeless and reaching out to help people who are struggling with like really heavy issues. And so that's kind of where I first heard about like To Write Love and like was introduced to Jamie. And so I follow him on like Instagram and Twitter and all of the social media stuff that I do. And I think that's kind of where I started seeing, you know, things about Heart Camp too. And just kind of this idea of like being in a time of transition, because I had just, you know, I had quit a job that I thought I would do forever. I had gone to grad school and had graduated. And then I had like started this job and was like still feeling very much adrift in this position because, you know, the hours I was working were not conducive to having a social life. You know, working from 9 to 6 and then getting home by like 6:37. You can't really do anything, especially if you have to get up and go to work again at like 9 next day, or working from like noon to 9 p.m. And so I just didn't have anywhere I kind of plugged in. I still felt like really adrift in this time of transition and trying to figure out like, is this where I want to be long term? I think even by this point, I kind of started thinking like, okay, I'm going to do a year. And then I'm going to go back to Missouri. And my year ended about 9 months into it, but that's okay. And so I kind of waffled back and forth about this idea of like signing up to go to this like Heart Camp thing in Florida in January. And I was like, okay, first of all, meeting people, super awkward, super introvert. Like, I'm going to sit there and it's going to be awkward. But there's just something about this idea of like authenticity and writing and kind of like self-examination in a small group setting that for whatever reason really appealed to me. And so I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do it. And I think I was probably one of the last people to sign up before it was sold out, because a lot of times I have like these really brilliant ideas, like I'm going to do this thing. And then I have a really big habit of like talking myself out of it, because I'm like, that's a terrible idea. You're going to hate it. It's going to be terrifying. Please don't.
Yeah. I do that about 50% of the time too. So I'm right there with you on that one.
And so I went ahead and went for it. And I sat down and I talked with the lady who was the branch manager at the time. And I was like, listen, I'm going to this like conference, seminar, workshop thing. I still don't really know how like to describe it. And I don't know if any of us do. And so I'm going to need to rearrange my schedule. If I'm gone these days, I can work these days to make up like my hours that I need. And so she was really wonderful at like helping me work my schedule out so that I could get to Heart Camp. And so the morning I'm supposed to fly out, I am flying out of Waco to Dallas, because that's the only place you can fly from Waco to. And then change planes a lot of stuff. And I get on the plane and we're sitting and we're waiting. And they're like, we're sorry, we can't actually start the plane because it's January. And even though it's Texas, it was so cold that this like weird random piece of equipment that they used to start the plane didn't work and couldn't start the plane. And so I've been like left to decide like, well, do I wait for them to start the plane or do I drive myself to Dallas to make my connecting flight? And so that's what I did. It's like 5 in the morning and I'm grabbing my carry-on because I've convinced myself that traveling with only a carry-on is the best way to travel.
Exactly.
And I hop in my car and I drive myself to Dallas.
How long of a drive is that?
It's about 2 hours.
Okay.
From Waco. I mean, it's not a horrible drive. And at like 5 in the morning, there's not a whole lot of anyone traffic on the road anyway. So, and I had kind of made arrangements through the Facebook group to meet with Kenneth, one of the guys who was at our heart camp. So I get there and I get to the gate and there he is. And he hasn't slept all night because he's flying in from the West Coast. And I've been up since super early. And so we're both kind of like, hey, how's it going?
Were you guys both on the same flight from Dallas?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't even realize that. Okay.
Yeah. We met us. We were on the same flight and all that stuff. And he's like, I was going to ask the guy who I was sitting next to if you'd mind trading seats. But he got real comfortable real fast. So I didn't want to disturb him. So
what was going through your head when you had to make that judgment call when you're sitting on the plane and figuring out whether you needed to take the initiative or like wait and see? Because obviously in that period of transition and just making the jump to do heart camp in the first place, was that like a, oh shit, I shouldn't have done this, or like, screw it, I'm going to get this done, you know, come hell or high water type thing?
You know, I think by this point, like we had been people had been talking in the Facebook group and we were like making plans. And I was like, well, listen, I've ponied up the money for this. Like, I've got to get myself there one way or the other. So I guess I'm driving to Dallas.
Yeah.
I don't know. And then like the whole way I'm like, this may be the worst idea I've ever had. Like committed. I had already like ponied up the money for like a plane ticket and the hotel and the registration fee. And I was like, well, I guess this is the thing I'm going to make myself do. So here we go. Let's get to Dallas and let's figure it out from there. And so then, you know, you're in a new airport. You have to go through TSA again. And in Dallas, they are not friendly TSA agents. I got yelled at by the TSA lady because I didn't know, like, so I had to put my suitcase also in a bin. And then
that's weird.
I'm TSA. Right. And so I'm TSA check, but I have an implantable medical device. And so I can't go through a metal detector. And so then they have to escort me over to the other lane and I have to go through the thing. And then the lady's screaming at me to take my shoes off. But I'm like, I don't have to take my shoes off. I'm TSA pre-check. And they're like, she's TSA pre-check. And she's like, well, get through the thing anyway. And it was just very stressful. And so that was kind of, again, like this idea of like, holy cow, have I made a terrible mistake? Mm-hmm. Like I'm being shouted at by the TSA lady. My flight wouldn't leave, like couldn't leave Waco. Like, is this a bad idea?
And yeah, you like, would think no. TSA would, I mean, at this point, be a little bit more amenable to people traveling, since usually people traveling, it ends up like that's out of the ordinary for most people. And so it ends up being something where when you see families or individuals that aren't usually dressed in button-ups or jackets or sport coats of some sort or something, they're generally doing something that's of significance in their lives. So, you know, yelling at people or screaming at them or interrogating them as to why they have a water bottle in their carry-on probably isn't the best idea or the most compassionate one. Right. But, that's where a little could go a long way in that space.
Absolutely. And so I finally, like, make it to the gate. I meet Kenneth. We take our flight. And then we get to Orlando and we go down to baggage check and I meet you and Amanda. And I said, you know, I am not a huggy person at all. I have become more of a huggy person being around all of you people who are very huggy. But like hugs from strangers is always like an awkward thing for me.
It's like your kryptonite. I get it.
Right. And so I'm like, oh, great. Hugs. Yay, let's hug. And so then, I think just by that point, I was convinced, that's all kind of like a roundabout way to say, like, I was convinced by this point that like, this is the thing I needed to do for myself. And so I was going to get there one way or another.
Yeah, I'm glad you phrased it that way, because that's, again, a common theme for many of the episodes and many of the conversations that we're having, where that ends up being the trip, the journey, the investment into yourself that everybody was needing to make, where having followed along with Right Love, having followed along with Jamie, read If You Feel Too Much, and just kind of being in the same space. And, you know, a lot of folks in the nonprofit space or in a period of transition and just looking to be more authentic and everything, it ends up being something that is or can be labeled as, you know, a professional conference or something, but it ends up being something that you're doing for yourself, for that personal growth that you need to think, to find, to feel, and then grow from there. So I'm glad that you phrase it that way. And I would think, based on the story that you alluded to earlier, you kind of found what you were looking for with the empowerment, the grace, and the ability to be authentic to yourself and kind of guide you through that transition afterwards.
Right. And I think, too, the other thing that I really feel like I found was just like this community of people. Like I said, I was so lonely in Texas. I had like one friend that I worked with, and she was wonderful. And I love, love, love her for being my friend and being so kind to me while I was there. But that was it for me. And as someone who's never had a ton of like super close friends anyway, like I have like acquaintances and I have like really good friends, I didn't realize how much I depended on those people and how much I love those people, how much I need those people. And so at Heart Camp, I kind of found that too, I feel. And so having those people I could reach out to when I was having a really rough day, or having people that like I knew, even if it was just like a tap back on like a message that I had sent to them or whatever, you know, knowing that there were people out there who kind of got me and kind of felt similar and had gone through like a similar shared experience, like Heart Camp, was really revolutionary for me too, I think.
Well, and that goes to a lot of your story so far, where, I mean, we can jump around here and circle back, and obviously that we don't have a linear path for a lot of this discussion, but you mentioned being the introvert and kind of being just very, you know, not in a negative sense, but generally closed in for yourself. And an inward thinker, inward feeler. And you've been in periods of isolation. And so now having that community that you know is surrounding you and supporting you has to go a long way and be super empowering, as opposed to feeling, whether it's physical, mental, or hypothesize, that you are like alone and separated and kind of pushed away from everything. So it had to kind of help with the just your growth and mental and physical health to kind of have that now, kind of like the clouds parting type thing, and having some of that visibility there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had a couple of really good friends that I made when I was in St. Louis, you know, and so we were kind of talking back and forth. And even when I went home at Thanksgiving, they were like, are you okay? Like, we notice you're not like talking as much in the group text, and you're not, you know, like something seems wrong. And so having people, you know, that know you and that can kind of sense those things, even through like text message or whatever, is really important. And I didn't realize how important that much that was to me and how much I needed that until I didn't really feel I had that. And so I think this idea, kind of one of the things that kind of sprang forth for me out of this whole like Heart Camp and everything situation, was just like how legitimately true that statement, people need other people, is.
Absolutely.
I did not realize how much I needed other people until I felt like I didn't have other people.
Yeah, that's a perfect one. And that's, I think, an excellent corollary to that, as far as the next logical extension for you don't realize how true that is until it's absent of the fact of the people that you would normally depend on or look to aren't there. And then you just realize how true that, you know, rather generic statement is, though.
Right. Absolutely. And sometimes I think, you know, cliches or generic statements are those things for a reason, because there is like a truth to them.
Exactly. So with the understanding of your introvertedness and your INFJ-ness, and then a lot of the conversation that we've had so far, you mentioned that you're familiar with the Enneagram. Now, were you familiar mm-hmm. with that before Heart Camp, or is that a Heart Camp development, or?
That is definitely a Heart Camp development.
Okay.
Kind of a, like, family group text development. Mm-hmm. I had, you know, I'd heard of, like, the Myers-Briggs, and I'd done that. And, like, every so often during our school professional development stuff, we'd have to do, like, the Four Corners stuff or whatever. Are you a north, a south, an east, or a west? And all of that stuff. And so I knew, like, my Myers-Briggs type, but I hadn't really heard of the Enneagram until Heart Camp. And so I kind of, I've never, like, paid for their official Enneagram test.
Neither have I.
Because, like, hi, no thank you. I'm not going to pay $12 for you to tell me that I'm an introvert because I already know that about
myself. And then also, once I pay you, you have my email and you're going to try to sell me on a bunch of other stuff that I can read elsewhere, generally at my own pace for free.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I just like did the Googling of like free Enneagram tests and found one. And I think you had shared one in the group text. And so, yeah, that was kind of my introduction to the Enneagram and to my fiveness.
So, okay, so that's what I was going to say, because I never remember my own Myers-Briggs. There are two things I remember about all sorts of personality tests. One is I'm a two, and yeah. Two is, I guess I could have reversed that, but one is I'm a two, and two is I'm a Ravenclaw. That's the only thing that I remember. So I don't remember my Myers-Briggs. I barely remember other people's Enneagrams and all that stuff, unless they tell me there are two because of, you know, misery loves company type thing.
Right.
So that's what I was going to say. I know we've talked about it. And then when everyone was here in September, Professor Katie was up on the window drawing with all of our numbers with dry erase markers and everything that for tracking both our Enneagram and colors from Ms. Candance and all that stuff. So I didn't remember exactly what your type was, but I was going to say it was definitely going to be a five, probably with like a wing six. So I don't know if you've gotten that far yet based on the Enneagram, but I'm glad I was able to at least nail the five part.
Oh yeah, I am very much a five, and I am also a Ravenclaw, which I think makes, if you know me and you know me well, that makes like, and really if you don't know me that well at all, that makes like total sense.
Well, you just said you were a librarian, so at some point that makes perfect sense that you're like, a Ravenclaw.
Right, it all just like adds up. Two and two in this case do equal four, and that's about as much math as I'm ever going to do. There's a reason I teach English. But yeah, I am a five, and I'm pretty sure I'm a wing six. I know when I took the test many moons ago, it gave me my wing, and I'm pretty sure it was a six wing. And everything I've read about the five wing six, I'm like, okay, yeah, that's me. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, makes sense. And where it ends up, it's been about 50-50 where folks have known about it beforehand or have become intimately familiar with it after Heart Camp. But there were like folks in my group that were wearing full-blown Enneagram t-shirts and things like that, so that's pretty awesome. And then just the fact of like Jamie's book,
now I kind of want one of those.
Exactly. And there's like Instagram and Twitter accounts like the Ennea dog, where it's obviously mashing dog pictures or like in the voice of we or like in the yeah in the sound of We Rate Dogs and all of that stuff. Like they do Enneagram type stuff. So
how did I not know that that was a thing? So why did you never tell me I'll that was
to,
a thing?
To send that over after we're done here. I think it's just like, if you search on either Instagram or Twitter, just Ennea dog, it'll be on there with some stuff there. So that would definitely be a thing to check out. But it's been interesting to see how kind of revelationary it's been for people to see that as part of both confirming their personality and then realizing a lot of what's been going on kind of the whole time and putting a lot of what they do in perspective.
No, I think that was the thing with the Enneagram for me. Like, I don't buy into a lot of like woo, like what I like to call like woo woo things. Mm-hmm. But with the Enneagram, like I feel there have just, you know, when I read anything about being a five or whatever, or like I see ridiculous Enneagram memes that are like Enneagrams on Halloween, and it's like the five, the light is off and the, you know, the curtains are closed and pretending like no one's home. I'm like, but also that's me. And so I think that's one of the things that I really have liked about the Enneagram, is that it is like very much true to my personality, but also it's given me like a really great insight into my personality and kind of how I function when things are going really well, and then how I function when things are not going well for me. And so I see a lot of that, like, I guess the dysfunction from that time when I was in Texas. And then I can see a lot of function now that, like, I'm in a place where I'm happy and I'm in a place where I feel supported and healthy and good and strong.
Yep. And it gives you that tool to figure out, how did I get here? Yeah. How did I get away from there? And then kind of that roadmap or a little bit of foresight to know how to navigate some of that in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, I think, something I've really liked about the Enneagram, as opposed to other personality tests I've taken, or like, because I come from like a religious background, and I'm still very much involved in like the church and stuff. And so you always do like the spiritual gift inventory. Mm-hmm. You know, like, your spiritual gift is encouragement and service. And I'm like, tell me something I don't already know. Thanks, Jesus. To me, it just seems like it's a lot more useful, I think, than other personality type tests. With like the Myers-Briggs, it's like, this is what you are. With the Enneagram, it's like, this is what you are, and here's kind of like how that develops and actualizes in your life.
Exactly. It ends up being the Myers-Briggs is, this is what you are, and Enneagram is more of like, this is why you are. And so it ends up giving you a little bit of that. So, and also 9 versus 16 is a little bit more grokkable at just having a number as opposed to like random letters like thrown together that are a combination.
Like weird chain of letters that mean different things.
Ends up being DNA as opposed to anything else.
Right.
With being a 5 and being an introvert and everything, I wasn't surprised that all of your self-care items that you mentioned in some of the prep, and even that I've come to know from you, wouldn't be any surprising there. So,
right.
I mean, you mentioned one of your favorite forms of self-care is secretly being a 90-year-old woman. So that ends up being a case where I would imagine that everything else stems from that, and kind of all of the other forms of recuperation, both mental and physical, there kind of are from that. So what are some of your other favorite forms of self-care as a 90-year-old woman living inside the body of a 30-year-old?
I'm a knitter. And so sometimes when I just need to do something mindless for a while, I love to bust out a set of knitting needles and some yarn and just do something super basic, like a scarf or a blanket, or just not even like working on a project with an end goal in mind. As a 90-year-old woman, I also like to go to bed really early on occasion. I just bought myself a sleep mask that I'm ridiculously excited about. It has contributed some really good nights of sleep lately. I think baking is another one I like to do. It gives me like a sense of accomplishment to like be able to follow a recipe and end up with something delicious that I then have to like pawn off on other people so I don't eat it all.
Does that coincide with the Great British Baking Show as well? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
I watch a lot of baking shows. I've been working my way through, well, for a while I've worked my way through the Great British Baking Show. I've watched some Nailed It on Netflix, but that one kind of stresses me out a little bit just because they have like unrealistic time constraints and they're trying to like make these really fantastic things with people who can't actually cook well.
Yeah.
And so that one stresses me out a little bit. But yeah, I've always loved like old people TV. I was in seventh heaven when Jeopardy put episodes on Netflix. And you know how excited I was about that. I think just like doing really mundane things is really, really great forms of self-care for me. Watching Jeopardy, baking, knitting, petting my dog when I come home, hanging out with my dog in the evenings, not going anywhere in the evenings. I think especially as a teacher, I have to be on all day with my students. And I told one of my coworkers the other day that I'm like a serious introvert, and she's very surprised by that. I said, that's because I've trained myself to present myself as not introverted when I'm at work, because I have to be entertaining. I have to be on. I have to try and keep my students' attention. And so then at the end of the day, if I can just come home and honestly not see another person for several hours, I am happy as a clam.
But I think that goes very well with, aside from ineffectual upper management, trying to think of the nicest way to put it in that phrase. But I mean, just in both of the roles that you had, where you've been successful and where you kind of still felt lacking, like that is something where I think that makes sense though. Like you said, you're going to work and putting on a face, acting, bringing in, you know, you're wearing a mask when you're at work to be front right. and center in front of the students. And then you come home and you just want to veg out. So it is something where that is a lot of work to both do the job role, but then also have the personality type and present yourself in that way. So that completely makes sense based on, you know, connecting with yourself and then being able to come home and just veg out and disconnect from everything.
I think that's absolutely right. And I don't, like, at this point, I don't, like, resent having to, like, put on this face all day, because I just know that, like, okay, it's my time to, like, pretend to be an extrovert, and I'm around people, and that's fine. But, man, it's always nice to come home and to not have to do that anymore. And even when I was at Heart Camp, and even when we went to Heavy and Light, and even, you know, when I came and visited in September, like, I was fine. Up until, like, I had reached my threshold. Yep. And so, like, when I came and visited in September, you know, it was good. And then I got home, and it was really nice to just, like, be for a while. Mm-hmm. Or, like, at Heart Camp, you know, I'd be like, sorry, I'm an old lady. I'm going up to bed while everyone else camped out in the hotel lobby until 2 a.m. Or, you know, Heavy and Light, they have, like, you guys got, like, the house together. And I was like, I love all of you, and I'm happy to come over and hang out with you. But also I'm getting my own hotel room so that I continue to love you and continue to want to hang out with you.
Yeah, because when you were saying that, I forgot that you ended up getting your own hotel room there, because I was like, what did Sarah do when we were there? But then I was like, okay, yeah, now I remember you had your own hotel room, and then ended up having the surprise of getting to stay with Katie and Jenny for another night after kind of flights were happening. But that was fine.
Yeah, that was good. I was really glad for that opportunity, because I love Katie and Jenny, but I didn't know them super, super, super well. And so sharing a hotel room with someone, even for like 12 hours, is like a really good way to get to know them quickly. Mm-hmm. And so I'm still like, I don't think I've ever even told them this, so they're going to like maybe cry when they hear this. I don't know, because that's what they do. And that's okay. That's wonderful. But I'm still like, I think about this all the time, like how grateful I am for the fact that they needed somewhere to crash for the night because of like things with the Airbnb and flights and stuff like that, so that I could get to know them more and I could get to like appreciate them even more than I already do. So shout out Katie and Jenny for sleeping in my spare bed.
That's good. That's good to hear. I know they'll both love that. Kind of piecing out, I'm done, I'm turning into a pumpkin, see you later type mentality is, you know, something that's pretty common. And I was actually just talking with someone from my group, and I have no idea what order any of these episodes will come out, since we're recording so far four into the future or in the past, depending on your perspective here. But just talking with Emily, and she mentioned the same thing, where she lives with roommates, but they would have people over, and then it was just like, tick, 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 tick. Okay, I'm done. I'm going upstairs. Nothing against you guys. Yeah. Great time. Thank you all for being here. I'm just done. I'm going to go sit in the dark, listen to some music, read, pass out, do all that stuff. And that's, you know, perfectly valid. But again, like you said, you're able to understand and navigate that from a learned five, as opposed to someone like me, where being a two, I have to make sure like we're always doing something together and figuring that out and doing that stuff. So that's why I'm always like, again, both with Amanda and I being twos, it's no surprise that both of us are into planning everything for other people. So that goes a long way, but it's good that you've come to know and be able to navigate that for yourself and figure that out in all of your different kind of circles of community.
And I think too, like, having people also that are not fives that do understand the fact that, like, I, as a five, like, the fact that I don't want to spend every waking minute with you doesn't mean I love you any less. Mm-hmm. It just means I need to have time to myself so I can continue to love you as much as I already do.
Exactly. I think that's the best nail in the head way to describe that is, as far as the all the different levels of love language and all of this stuff. But as a five, that's exactly the way to kind of put that in, to put a bow on that and all your kind of interactions there. What's, as we start to wrap up, what is one thing that you'd want someone to take away from your story?
I think this idea, well, let me back that up. When I was living in St. Louis, I had the chance to go and see Jamie speak at a university. There's actually a chapter in the revised edition of If You Feel Too Much where he talks about that night at Lindenwood University, and I was there. And Renee came and spoke and sang too, and it was really fantastic. And she, I think there's a line in a song that she sings that it's, you're only stuck if you say you are. And I think that's the thing that I've had to learn as I've lived my journey and lived my story, that I don't have to stay in a situation that is unhealthy for me. Mm-hmm. I don't have to stay in a situation that I'm unhappy in. And so I think that's what I would like people to take away, is this idea that you're only stuck if you say you are. If the situation is unhealthy, you need to find a way out of it. If you are miserable enough to where you cannot bear the idea of getting out of bed and going to work, that is a situation you need to figure out how to remove yourself from. And it may not happen as instantly as it did for me. You may not have those people in your life that can say, okay, we'll bring you home and we will take you in and we'll take care of you. But you need to work on figuring out how to get yourself out of that situation. And I think I had to learn for myself that I'm not a disappointment if I say, this isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
I have to remember, and I think other people have to remember too, that quitting a job does not mean that you're a failure. Leaving a place that you moved, that you're so excited about moving to, that ended up not working out, does not mean you're a failure. So just, I think, having grace for yourself and realizing that you don't have to stay stuck. If any of that makes any sense at all.
It makes absolute sense. I mean, we're raised in, for most of us, and probably, well, based on knowing the statistics of this podcast, most of our listeners, in the American sense of, always succeed, onward and upward,
right,
keep going, never fail, and all of that stuff. And so when you have to make a change, pivot, something doesn't work out, we've generally conditioned from a very young age to make it feel like it's a failure type thing, as opposed to it being a case where now, being for working almost half my life in a corporate setting, I've seen more people fail upwards than actually purposely successfully drive upwards. So it ends up being a case where you may not always be working on the exact thing right now that will get you somewhere, but going through the experience, taking it, and then knowing that you're not right in that situation and finding where you can go to is, paramount in your eventual success, eventual journey, that you will be able to find what you want to succeed in and what you want to thrive in. So yeah, all of that made absolute sense.
Okay, good.
So the last question we'll wrap up with, and I don't know if I added this after you submitted some of your stuff, and I don't know if you've seen this in any of the stuff we put out, but what is one song that you'd want to share about your story? Hell, if you want, we can put the Jeopardy theme song on there, or Final Jeopardy.
Because I've listened to a couple of episodes, and I have several more on my phone to listen to on my drive to St. Louis this weekend for Christmas break, I, like everyone else, or most everyone else, I've had a really hard time narrowing it down to one, so I have two.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm an English teacher. I can't count. So the first one is called Swim by Jax Mannequin, and it is a song that makes me feel strong. It makes me feel brave, and I love everything about it. So that would be one, Swim by Jax Mannequin. And then the other song is one that I put on our Heart Camp playlist that we put together, and it is called In My Mind by Amanda Palmer. I got into Amanda Palmer because she is married to the world's greatest author, Neil Gaiman.
Okay, that's what I was going to say. I thought that's who that was.
Yeah. And she sings this song called In My Mind. And in it, she talks about, like, at first, in the future, you know, 5 years from now, I'm going to be all these things. I'm going to do all of these things. I'm going to be a different, better person than I am now. And it kind of, like, ends with this idea that you are exactly who you thought you would be, or you are exactly who you want to be, or who you should want to be anyway. Like, you don't have to be all these things that you thought you were going to be. You are good and you are fine just as you are. And so I love that one.
That's another excellent addition. From, I haven't listened to too much Jax Mannequin, but I have friends from college that were huge Jax Mannequin fans. So that's, I'm glad to see them make an entrance here. And it's only fitting that you would add Amanda Palmer based on kind of the context of the song, but then also being married to Neil Gaiman and talking about all of the librarianness and everything where we've gone so far. So that kind of comes full circle and puts a nice little bow on it there for me.
Yeah, that's, you know, I do what I can, and if I can tie it back to literature, I will. Especially if it's Neil Gaiman, because if you're not reading him, you should be.
Thank you so very much for joining us this week. We hope you had as good a time listening as we had recording the interview. Don't forget to check out anthologiesofhope.com/playlist. For all the awesome songs that will get added each week. You can find us on social media at Anthologies of Hope on Facebook and Instagram, and Anthologies Pod on Twitter. It would be great if you could subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google, and leave us a review. As always, remember, everyone has a story, and it's about time we start listening.